The sound of this doorbell may seem pretty ordinary to you, until you realize that it's Graham, who's 75 years old and still delivering meals to people in need in his neighborhood. And that for many of them, it's the most comforting sound they'll hear all day. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Boutu. This past weekend, on the 18th of March, Palestinians all over the West Bank participated in the 8th Palestine Marathon in the city of Bethlehem after a two-year hiatus due to the pandemic. Established in 2013, the Palestine Marathon takes place with races including a marathon, 42 kilometers long, a half marathon at 21 kilometers, and 5 and 10 kilometer races as well. The marathon requires a 42 kilometer stretch within occupied Palestine. But due to Israeli checkpoints and the apartheid wall, Palestinians instead run back and forth across Bethlehem 4 times in order to make the 42 kilometers. The race begins at Manger Square at the Church of the Nativity and continues throughout the city, passing refugee camps and along the apartheid wall. The marathon was started by the Right to Movement campaign to highlight movement restrictions in occupied Palestine. Palestinians live under some of the harshest movement restrictions, whether it's walking or driving through Israeli checkpoints daily, or being required to obtain permits to move throughout the country or to go between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The aim of the Right to Movement campaign is simple: to highlight the limitations of Palestinian movement and to demand Palestinian freedom. In 2017, the Palestinian Authority took over control of the marathon and has been running it ever since. We speak to the co-founder of the Right to Movement campaign, George Zidan, an unsung hero who has inspired so many people to start running, and who tells us about how the Right to Movement campaign came to be, how he thought of the marathon itself, and what freedom of movement means for Palestinians.
We were talking earlier about when the Right to Movement started the campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Okay. So we started in 2012 It was an initiative of a few Danish activists and a few Palestinian activists. We didn't call it Right to Movement back then. The name, what we had in mind is the idea was we needed to do something that grabs attention at a big scale of people, large scale of people, to the problems and the limitations that the occupation causes in our daily life through something that people can resonate with. And we were in marathon, just bringing people together, a large sum of people. It's fun, it's exciting. And that was where we started. We said we would do the first marathon in Palestine. I remember how I just didn't think that it was something like, what was a marathon? You know, there would be, I grew up here in the West Bank and every day there was a marathon. But our understanding of a marathon was a very different. It was like, if there's a 2K race or a 2 mile race, people would call it, any running race would be called a marathon. So we didn't even, like, we didn't understand what is a marathon. So we said, okay, and said, George, we would like to find 42 kilometers for the trail of the marathon. And I'm like, yeah, sure, we can find 42 kilometers. And then I had no idea in my mind what was, like, what would be 42 kilometers like, how. And then we started driving around in Bethlehem, just like on the car meter, and then everything we're getting, like we're going everywhere from every corner of the city, and we got 8-9 kilometers. And then, okay, this is, we have a problem, we have a situation. And that's where we started thinking about highlighting this issue of right to movement. So we cannot do the race in area B or C, because we cannot jeopardize that an Israeli soldier who might just be having a bad day decide to intervene and stop. Not that they cannot do it in area A, but at least we are within the PA administered areas in area A, and it's within the control, supposed control of the Palestinian Authority. We're limited to this area of the West Bank, which is quite small,
yes,
especially
18%.
Yeah, 18%, and then Bethlehem specifically has, I think, 70% of Bethlehem is on Area C, and it's, so we ran into this issue of how we're going to complete a trail, and that's where we said, we actually spoke to a family in a village, Al-Khadr village, to let us go through their backyard and extend the trail of the race to 10.5 kilometers, and then, so you start from the Church of Nativity. The idea that was, you start at like the square, the public square in the city, a famous spot, and then you go to the end of Area A, and you pass by every corner in the city, and you finish 10.5 kilometers. So if you want to do a half marathon, you go back and forth, and if you want to do a full marathon, you have to do the same route 4 times, A, B, back to A, and arrive to the finish line, which is, if anybody is a runner, will understand how hard it is to arrive to the finish line, feel like you have finished, because part of running is mentally, a lot of part of it is mental, and then, oh my gosh, I have to start and go again and do the whole thing again. And we wanted just to give people an experience of understanding what is it running under occupation, what is life under occupation. We did not create the trail for people to experience it for one day. It resembles the reality of our everyday life. You know, when you go to school in Palestine, where we can even build or expand our cities is limited by the Israeli occupation. And when you run the marathon in Palestine, you're running by the apartheid wall, by Israeli checkpoints, by land that has been confiscated or will be confiscated for settlement through Palestinian refugee camps. And it's the same way you go to school, it's the same way you go to work in Palestine, it's the same way you run. So we wanted to give people an opportunity to come and experience a professional day, a happy day, enjoying a happy festive day, but also understand the situation and the violations that we experience in our everyday life.
So just to be clear, you couldn't find a place in Palestine that was 42 kilometers straight.
So we had, our intent was to do the race in Bethlehem, because Bethlehem is a very famous city, and Bethlehem has the capacity to host tourists. Like, we may have been able to do it in Jenin on Strait. I'm not sure. That's what we always assume. That's an assumption that we always make, that maybe we would have been able to make it in Jenin. But I'm not sure. I don't know. Yeah. But
also there's no big open space. There's no big major square where people would be able to.
Exactly, and the idea of doing the race in the most acknowledged city. If you're anywhere from New Zealand or from Madagascar to Canada, you would understand Bethlehem somehow, and it's the city that has hotel rooms. Like, we cannot do it in Jenin. Jenin does not have the infrastructure to take that many tourists. So we were kind of stuck, but in a good way, with Bethlehem, and then stuck in a bad way with the situation on the ground and the reality that we are so limited in where we can run. And this is something we used to. You know, even when we train here, you train outside your home in the same street, because you don't know if you end up like going in a wrong direction, you will end up being close by settlers. You put yourself at risk. Your family wouldn't feel okay with that. They would feel like, whenever I was living with my parents and I would go on a run, they always like, be careful if you're by the settlement. Be careful, and just right outside my house. So it's something like in the back of your head. Yeah.
So when you started the marathon, I'm sure you didn't anticipate all of the problems. What were some of the problems other than the just physical, trying to find which is a problem, and it's, I think, a unique problem.
Yeah.
Trying to find a trail. What was the next, or trying to find a path, excuse me, what were some of the other problems that you faced?
Some of it were related to the fact that we don't have autonomy over our borders. Okay. So we cannot control if runners who register can actually come into Bethlehem and participate in the race, because what could happen is, and it has happened in many situations, is that the Israeli occupation authorities will prevent runners who participate from abroad to enter and come to the race. So there's always this back fake story why they're coming for pilgrimage reasons. And if someone just shows up without having a connection with us or a contact with us, we cannot control to give them the story, the between brackets story that they should come up with. So that was very difficult. We were very challenged as well in terms of runners coming from Gaza. We organized the race for 4 years, and only one out of the 4 years, the Israeli occupation allowed runners from Gaza to come and participate in the marathon. For 3 years, they would reject the permits with no premises, it's very hard for Gazans to be anywhere except for Gaza. So it was, it was something sad that we always ran into. And I think just one of the things that we really worked hard, so we started the marathon, and then we started, like, the easiest way to understand it is like a byproduct of running groups. And these running groups, which we have now 5 active in Haifa, Jaffa, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and Ramallah, the idea is like we get people to train for the marathon, to come and introduce a culture of running among in these cities, and try to get people excited about the event. And one of the things that we really worked hard on and has been the focus of our group is to create an atmosphere, an environment that is welcoming and friendly for Palestinian women to be out doing sports in the street. You know, we live in a patriarchal, male-dominated society that is not very much open for women to do anything they would like to do, not in terms of running only. Very controlling, and what we tried to do through our groups is being conscious of this, try to introduce this community environment where we make the women feel that they're very welcome, safe space for them to be there, be able to run in the street, being respected as equally and as their male counterpart. So the idea is to have Palestinian men and women run in equal numbers.
One of the things that struck me the most was just how festive the marathon was in the years that I participated. And not just festive, but families joining, saw lots of little kids. And that was really lovely. It was one of the few places and spaces where you saw just all walks of life, all ages gathered together.
we tell people you come and you enjoy a professional base, and but with the Palestinian touch. You know, we're on the like finish line dancing debke. At the stations, people are giving the runners Palestinian dates from Jericho. You know, you will get a boring gel if you're running New York City Marathon. We're giving you Palestinian exotic dates from the fresh from the farms, and people are wearing all sorts of traditional stuff, and it's a happy day. It's like a happy day. Like people are having fun. Everybody's excited. Everybody's motivated. I think we need a lot more of these days in Palestine, considering how depressing and how difficult it is to be here and to live here.
But your work doesn't stop just at the marathon. Right? The marathon is now run by the Palestinian Authority, but your work hasn't stopped.
Correct.
So yeah. What is it that you're, what is the Right to Movement doing now?
So in 2017, it was the first version of the race that was organized by the Palestinian Authority. We're a volunteer group, and everybody involved is putting time passionately towards really maintaining what we do and focusing on this happy lifestyle that we try to introduce. So we have the 5 active running groups that are led, each is led by a female and male leader, and we promote these events on a weekly basis for free. Things like hiking, running, yoga classes, boot camp classes in the different cities. We try to encourage people to show up and come, and from different levels, different ages, and have a good training, have fun together. That's been something that we have been doing consistently since the marathon and until now. We're also do what we call like some innovative advocacy. I don't want to use the same advocacy because I think it has been misused and abused in many ways, but some international awareness stuff through creative sports related issues. So we ran in 2016 over Christmas Eve, we had 22 Palestinian runners, 11 Marys and 11 Josephs running, wearing traditional clothes similar to what Mary, I don't know how Mary and Joseph, what were they wearing in 2000 years ago, I'm not gonna claim that, but something similar. And we ran in like as couples, as Mary and Joseph, relay run from Nazareth to Bethlehem. The idea was that we will document how after 2016 years, what the trip would be like for Mary and Joseph, how many settlements they have to pass, how many checkpoints they have to cross, what they have to walk and run or walk by the wall, and how it would have been different, trying to draw attention on the famous story, not for biblical reasons, but for the fact that people will understand the story, and try to illustrate it to people, what is it like after 2016 years ago, 2016 years. So we arrived in the Church of Nativity, and we had, yeah, it was also a festive, and then we did a campaign in Silicon Valley with a nonprofit with a 501c3 called Rebuilding Alliance, where we worked with a congresswoman, Anna Esho, I think her name, Democrat, on challenging tech giants in terms of their navigation of specifically Palestinian villages in AIC. There were about 542 villages that were not included in the navigation at that time in 2016. And we made a strong push. We went to their campuses. We did the run between their campuses, and we worked on lots of campaigning activities. They were arguing that this is like Palestine is not recognized as a country by the US and like many international like European countries, etc. So they cannot have the full navigation of these villages, or not recognized as like Palestinian villages. And at the same time, they had every Israeli illegal settlement that has not been recognized as legal by anyone except by the Trump administration. And they had them fully navigated to the every small corner and bakery that exists in these settlements. So we were trying to demonstrate the double standards. They said, okay, you don't want to recognize our villages who are existing in reality and you're omitting it from your maps, but at the same time you're existing these Israeli settlements. We managed to get some progress done on this. We had, it wasn't also the work alone of Right to Movement and this congresswoman. There were other Palestinian organizations that were also involved, like the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem and others. And then they successfully navigated around 230, I think. I'm sure of the 542, I think 230 villages they navigated it in their navigation, included the name. And just the basic minimum, just include that this village exists. Our whole like slogan, we were afraid of the campaign, that we were afraid that the technology would change the reality, because they exist in reality, but they don't exist in technology. And other campaigns we've been working. We did a great campaign with UNRWA, USA. We sent Palestinian runners to run from New York City to the Congress. It was during the United Nations in November. This was November United Nations event. And delivering messages to Congress members in terms of funding. It was during 2018, during the Trump when he stopped the funding of the UNRWA and all the attempt to remove the Palestinian refugee. We're totally not focused on the funding, but on the attempt of removing the Palestinian refugee matter from any future solution by terminating the presence of an organization, the only organization that is responsible for providing food and education and healthcare for these 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. So we did the campaign. I think we raised $50,000 for UNRWA USA, and that was great as well. So just putting sports, putting our legs in action, trying to generate interest and differences the people see this place.
So what's next? What's any future plans?
Yeah, we have been, the focus has been now on a Swedish concept called blogging. The idea is that, it's funny when we say this because this is not what we do in Palestine at all, when you understand our context. So in Sweden, people will be running in the forest and they will clean while they're running. So the idea is like you're squatting down to pick up trash. So we said we would do this concept here in Palestine, but we were astonished. I shouldn't say astonished because I'm from here. So I understand that this is the reality, but the awareness on preservation of environment and protecting, being like leaving no trace behind you, is when you're out and having a picnic or something, is not yet there. So we are challenging our own community with that, with organizing events and in different parts of the West Bank, in Mahrour area, in Bethlehem, in Kremizan area, in Bejak, the places where people go for walks and can be suitable for this. In the city center in Ramallah, Duwar al-Manara, Manara roundabout, calling for volunteers to come and remove trash from the ground. So it ends up being mostly squatting and running and squatting with the situation. But it's also that people have this feeling that because our land is occupied, that it's kind of not my responsibility. And I see the logic sometimes, but it's a dangerous thought because we have to own up and be responsible ourselves in dealing with our own shit, excuse my French. And this is what we are trying to do now.
Well, George, thank you. You're one of the unsung heroes.
No.
I thank you for your motivation, for your inspiration, for your energy, for your passion, for the vision, for getting us moving and getting us thinking about Palestine in ways that are way beyond just our own little cities and towns. Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard.
No, thank you. It makes me thank you for saying this, and We really appreciate it, and we hope to see you with us. And,
we'll be
and
coming.
we invite people to come and you know get moving in Palestine. Find it's a great country and a great place to be. And there's lots of things to learn and experience when you come here. It takes only people coming to visit here to understand what they have been fed over and over in the past years is propaganda, and that there's only there's two unequal sides, an oppressor and the oppressed. And they I think it would be easy for people to know where they're associating, which side they're associating with. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
صوت في سكوت الليل بيناديني خلى دموعي تفر من عيني على فين يا موج الشوق موديني الحلم ولين الوان وقمر بصوت مرمر بيندهلني بضم قلبي وطير مع المواويل واتمشى فوق الموج على مهلي بحلم يا دنيا بلاش تصحي على فين يا موج الشوق مودي والريح بحس جريح بيوعدني ياخدني من حزني ويبعدني ويجيب لي حب حقيقي يساعدني في رحلة الأيام ويساعدني وحنانه يروي شوقي وحنينه على فين يا موج الشوق موديني بحلم بدنيا يحبها وتحب ناس هتشيلها فوق راسها والحب ساسها ودار في أنفاسها والعيد لاتي يدقي أجرسها بحلم أطير وأفرد جناحيني على فين يا موج الشوق سكوت الليل بحلم يا دنيا بلاش تصحيني على فين يا موج الشوق يوديني
The question for Palestinians becomes, do we reject this paradigm? Do we use every lever to push for liberation, even if we lose some of what so many sacrificed so much for, even if it means rejecting certain streams of financial support, even if it means we have to completely rethink how we construct our economy and educational system and health system and push back against governmental actors that have proven they will retaliate?
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. In December 2021, Shabaka published a policy brief entitled A Vision for Liberation, Palestinian-led Development in Health and Education by Dr. Yara Asi, Assistant Professor at the University of Central Florida and a previous US Visiting Fellow for Shabaka. In it, Dr. Asi discusses how the Palestinian health and education sectors in the West Bank and Gaza have been neglected by the Palestinian authorities and the donor community for decades. Indeed, the security sector consumes more of the PA's budget than the health, education, and agricultural sectors combined. And yet both health and education are fundamental human needs and rights. And a population that is both healthy and has access to education is more able and better poised to develop a movement for liberation. Based on qualitative interviews with scholars, activists, teachers, engineers, lawyers, doctors, shopkeepers, construction workers, and students across colonized Palestine, and in the diaspora, Dr. Asi attempts to address what a Palestinian vision for development that would bring about liberation and free Palestinians of donor-imposed conditions and restrictions would look like. Dr. Asi, thank you so much for joining me on Rethinking Palestine.
Hi, Yara. Thanks for having me.
Firstly, can you lay out briefly the current state of the health and education sectors in the West Bank and Gaza, and what are the reasons for that state?
So I think this is a really important place to start this conversation. So what's interesting about these sectors is that both have demonstrated quantitative improvement in the recent decades, undeniably, like much of the Middle East. Although there are very few longitudinal statistics from before the Oslo period in the mid-1990s, unfortunately, what we do have shows on the surface good news. So you had a life expectancy of just about 68 years old in 1990. Today, it's closer to 74 years. You had a literacy rate near 90% just decades ago. Now it's closer to 98% for adults and youth, boys and girls. You have immunization rates for the standard vaccines like measles, polio, rubella at nearly 100%. So on these basic measures, Palestine, and again, here we're referring to the West Bank and Gaza Strip, are doing quite well, actually outperforming many countries with similar economic indicators and definitely outperforming other conflict-affected countries. You'd think of Yemen or Syria, for example. This is in large part a result of this massive influx of aid from the West since the Oslo Accords, but it's also representative of the fact that due to centuries of colonialism, Palestine was greatly underdeveloped beforehand, even by the standards of the region. So all of the region was colonized essentially at the turn of the 20th century, but by the early to mid-1900s, many of the countries in the Arab world that we recognize today were establishing themselves. At that same time, however, Palestinians had experienced the Nakba, of course, in 1948, and then the beginning of this violent and restrictive military occupation and this ongoing settler colonial project. To the Ottomans and the British, you know, Palestinian health and education were not necessarily priorities to the extent to which they didn't affect their own local populations that were there. So health was largely left to local healers or to doctors who trained elsewhere and returned to Palestine, whereas education was mostly primary education, and even then mostly for boys. If you wanted to go to university, you're having to go to Syria or Turkey, most likely. So many Palestinian institutions started to develop in the mid-20th century in the absence of a state, not in the development of one. So when you look at the system today, you have this foundation of this largely neglected structure. You have this underserved, fragmented, and oppressed population. And then on top of that shaky foundation is this hastily built system, which was given a lot of attention and advice and money from all these outside actors that had very political motivations, and they wanted a lot of good outcomes quickly. So they're not necessarily thinking about what is best for the Palestinians in these territories in the long term. And as part of that, they purposefully ignored and continue to ignore the fundamental causes of the conflict and the continuing violations. Then you have Palestinian governance, who has never really grappled with the responsibility of governance and advocacy, highly corrupt, highly authoritarian. But there was just enough aid to build schools and hospitals and pave roads. And so when you look at these standard measures of development, there's a lot of positives. There's a lot of check marks here. But just beneath the surface, there are a lot of issues. And when you start to look at the quality and accessibility of these sectors, and especially when you see how disconnected they've become from the populations they're serving, you realize that these are not sustainable systems and they were never meant to be.
Obviously, the pandemic highlighted to a mainstream audience many of the deficiencies of the Palestinian health sector in the West Bank and Gaza. What in particular stood out for you?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I and many others wrote about how the pandemic kind of exposed this governance limbo, I guess, that Palestinians are in, especially when it comes for who is responsible for them in a crisis. And for any listeners who want more detail about that specifically, I wrote a piece for Al Shabaka in November 2020 about the pandemic. Although the pandemic was uniquely disruptive, I mean, for all of us, right? It also presented a unique opportunity, as you said, for the rest of the world to have even a brief understanding of what Palestinians experience regularly. So you have Israel on the one hand, perfectly comfortable with abdicating its role as an occupying power because it does not see itself that way. And then Palestinian governments, which has spent so much time and money formalizing itself without actually advocating for the power that it would need to resemble anything like a sovereign government. I mean, remember, we know they still don't control their own borders. They are not allowed to build an airport. They don't even control the movement of their own residents. This is not an environment where a health system can thrive. On top of that, you have this economy that's been strangled for years. And so that has greatly limited what the state is willing to spend on health. They spend this outsized money on security. So you have this medical sector that is under-resourced. And I mean, I'm talking in terms of Gaza, even on basic goods like IV bags and gauze. You have a population that can't move freely, even for emergency medical care. In some cases, you see literally ambulances blocked at checkpoints. You have a population that is fragmented, such that Palestinians from Gaza can't even access care in the West Bank or East Jerusalem without Israeli-issued permits. I had an interviewee who was a retired physician that worked in Nablus, and he was very anxious about the future of the medical sector because they're simply not training enough people to replace this current generation of doctors, and especially specialists. And the problem with this is this only further pushes Palestinians to leave the territories to receive either medical education or training, in which case you wonder how many of them will come back, or to receive medical care, which, you know, as a result of this arbitrary medical permit system, not everyone who needs the care can get it. And many of my interviews argued that this de-development and this fragmentation in these vital life sectors like health are wholly intentional and are meant to disconnect Palestinians from Palestine or whatever Palestine could be.
So sticking with the health sector, Yara, you discussed the resurgence of this discussion around decolonizing global health, and that an interviewee even suggested that Palestine could serve as a model for that movement. What does it mean to decolonize health sectors, and what could steps towards that look like in Palestine?
So in the global health literature, I would say for the past 2 or 3 years especially, there has been this increasing call for decolonization in global health. So what does this mean? So this is an ongoing and emerging conversation. There's multiple definitions of exactly what this means, depending on who you ask, where they live, and what their job is. So if you ask someone from the global north who is in a university, they will have a different answer than a community health worker from the global south, for example. So talking about that specifically could take up an entire podcast. So I recommend your listeners look into some of the really interesting scholarship and debates that have come out in recent years about decolonization in health. However, at its core, decolonization is about disrupting power, about identifying and removing forms of supremacy, about, in many cases, like Palestine, literally dismantling colonial structures and legacies. So as you can imagine, this is a large and decentralized project. There's no leader for this. This is, at this point, really a bunch of academics and practitioners having conversations among themselves about what this could look like. Some even hesitate to call it a project or a movement. The problem with these ideas as discussed today is that they still largely stem from the global north about the global south. And many of these discussions exclude the very people they claim to want to support and liberate. You see this especially in this humanitarian aid model that's imposed on Palestinians. Well, we're just trying to help you. We're helping you. How could that be bad, right? So Palestine is unfortunately a perfect microcosm of this. Palestinians are rarely seen as the best arbiters of what Palestinians want or need. They're rarely even trusted as witnesses of their own experiences. They're constantly questioned. They're seen as biased. They're seen as perhaps even in some circles uncivilized and ununderstanding of the realities of the world, so to speak. So decolonization in this sense involves centering Palestinians and Palestinian voices, embracing indigenous health. So, you know, the health system in Palestine and in many health systems that were created by donors essentially were built to resemble the health systems that the donors themselves had, these kind of very neoliberal, very capitalist, very individualistic models of health. And decolonization would involve almost a radical transformation of a health system that serves its population and not the entities that have paid for it for decades. It is Palestinians shaping their own narrative, identifying their own needs, and going forth to pursue them without needing the permission or approval of external actors. So it's not a short-term project, but then again, none of this is.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis, and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
So let's switch gears and look at the education sector, which you described as lacking vision. What exactly do you mean by that? And talk to me about the particular challenges that are coming from the donor community.
Yeah, so talk about a white savior complex, right? So I would say in my interviews for this Al Shabaka brief, some of the most interesting and philosophical conversations I had were about education, because education is so important in Palestinian communities, in Palestinian households. You know, it is seen as such an important, you know, thing to hold in a family, to get a better life, to, as you know, increase your station in life. And yet what the interviewees wanted to talk about was, first, let's reflect on what the value of education is. What is the purpose of education? I think most of us would agree that skill training for employment is definitely part of it, but it definitely not all of it, or at least it shouldn't be. There is a deeper purpose, especially when you have a population that is experiencing this collective trauma in a world essentially blind to their daily experiences. Education is a connection from the present to the past. It is this opportunity, a rare opportunity for self-reflection and community reflection on lived reality. At its best, education awakens the student from being limited to what they merely witness in their own lives and connects them to the wisdom and experiences and history that they otherwise have little opportunity to explore. Again, this was emphasized by so many of my interviewees. Education in Palestine should look nothing like education elsewhere, because Palestine is like nowhere else facing challenges few populations have to face. So education, and especially primary education, is the best opportunity to reach youth who are still energetic and engaged and have fresh and new ideas. It is the best opportunity to teach them critical thinking skills, and again, going back to history and about genuine collaboration and how to build something sustainable and meaningful regardless of whatever their job is. And all of this sounds so great, right? But most of that is not the donor's priority. And even if it was, unless they engage meaningfully with local staff and allow local curriculum development, they're not going to be able to do it adequately anyway. And that's the problem. Donors are not concerned with vision because that's not quantifiable. That doesn't make Palestinians good workers. And that's what they are concerned with. I don't say this to mean that many in the education humanitarian sector don't have genuinely good intentions, but they have intentions imposed from the outside about what Palestinian development and especially education should look like. One of the ways donors have this outsized role is in textbooks. Because of fears of being charged with incitement or even anti-Semitism, donors have this really outsized interest in textbooks, especially in Palestinian primary schools and especially in UNRWA. So I heard several anecdotes from interviewees about ways donors would request changes in books to appear more quote unquote balanced, when really they were insisting on erasing Palestinian narratives and Palestinian history. So you have to think, what kind of education are Palestinians really being given and to what end?
Despite all the challenges and barriers that you identify, there are of course still possibilities for internal transformations. What could some of these transformations look like?
You know, obviously there was, as you say, there's a lot of negative aspects of these conversations that can be kind of depressing. But I talked to almost 20 people, and what I was really encouraged by was they have so many good ideas. I mean, everyone brought different ideas to the table. Some people had ideas about how to reform education, how to incorporate more cultural education. So having dance troupes and olive picking events and kind of having this more holistic Palestinian approach to education. Some were more supportive of kind of exchange programs for Palestinian doctors, where they would train in specialties that aren't currently available in Palestine, but then the government would have some sort of incentive for them to come back and stay in Palestine. A lot of people who leave Palestine for stable work don't necessarily want to leave. There's just nothing for them to return. So a lot of people had ideas for incentives about guaranteed wages, guaranteed housing, you know, other ways that we could rethink, especially higher level jobs in education and health that would encourage young Palestinians to pursue them. I think the most important thing that I gathered, and the thing that I was most encouraged and motivated and inspired by, was that there are so many ideas, especially with the younger people that I talk to. I mean, they are so plugged into what's going on. There's no surrender here. They have not given up. They are not willing to acquiesce their future to, you know, they talk to their parents and grandparents and they're kind of like, oh, nothing will change. You know, I've seen this for decades. You know, the youth, they don't embrace that, at least not yet. They're not cynical yet. And so for me, it was, wow, how much are we losing by not hearing these voices otherwise? Why aren't these people being elevated? You know, people that have a tiny little NGO with just 3 or 4 people that are trying to change something in education or change something in their village or change something in the health sector. We need to elevate these voices. They really exist. And that, to me, instead of hearing resignation, instead of hearing just cynicism, I heard a lot of optimism and hope, and they just wanted an opportunity to be able to explore it, try it, see if it works. If it doesn't, try something else, right? I mean, that's part of the process. And so they just need the boot to be lifted off their neck, so to speak.
Yada, thank you for sharing that piece of optimism. It's always important to hear. And I want to end on a quote from one of your interviewees. They say, is the goal to create development and an economy around survival, or is it to create an economy and development process aimed at liberation? If it is liberation, you have to know that you're not going to be as economically comfortable. Can you explain this to our listeners? What does that mean?
Ah, yes. So this was a dilemma that I heard expressed from a lot of my respondents, and especially from those who don't currently live in the occupied territory. So those who, like myself, live in the diaspora, those who are forcibly exiled, or those who live behind the green line. The reality is things could hobble along as is for some undefined period of time into the future. Donors could keep providing just enough support to prevent, any significant change in the, again, quote unquote, status quo from the Palestinian side. And you know something, this paradigm has resulted in significant development over just a generation or two. I mean, when I was young, visiting my mother's village, not a single person had a car. If you needed to get to the city, you had to have arranged a taxi way ahead of time or get lucky and catch one that someone else had booked. Today, in that same village, almost every household has at least one car. They're driving on newly paved roads, and they can now drive to get sushi or pizza in Ramallah or Nablus, you know, assuming there's no checkpoint. It's a completely different experience, and on the surface, it mimics the lives of their peers in Jordan or Lebanon. The GDP of the West Bank and Gaza has increased nearly sixfold since 1994, but this is an artificial situation. This so-called economic improvement is built as a house of cards. It is occurring in this context of increasing political strangulation from all sides. There's no good endpoint for the trends we're seeing in the home demolitions, the settler violence, this right-wing drift of Israeli politics, and the impunity the rest of the world seems prepared to give to all of it. So as that interviewee kind of boiled it down, the question for Palestinians becomes, do we reject this paradigm? Do we use every lever to push for liberation, even if we lose some of what so many sacrificed so much for, even if it means rejecting certain streams of financial support, even if it means we have to completely rethink how we construct our economy and educational system and health system and push back against governmental actors that have proven they will retaliate against opposition? Do we embrace this collectivist effort that in the short term, at least, could cause real economic pain and hardship for some? Or do we continue to work within the current paradigm, try to find ways to make it work, work towards incremental change, try to leverage international relationships, try to find ways to individually prosper or at the very least survive and hope that at some point something changes on the outside? You know, for these people that have been so oppressed and marginalized, is it fair to ask them to potentially give up on some economic comforts for this abstract goal of liberation that at the moment at least seems, you know, quite distant? While it certainly isn't my place to answer that, and that's not what I was trying to do in the piece, because these are large, complex questions that need to be answered by a larger Palestinian movement that really considers the reality of the world today. But I do think that Palestinians, and especially those in the occupied territories and their allies outside, do need to start at least having these kinds of hard conversations, like what are we really pushing for? What is our next steps? So that we do have a vision for our next steps, for what we collectively want to move towards. So I hope this policy brief, you know, although there's these tensions within it, because it was so informed by Palestinians of such varying backgrounds, I hope it can at least contribute to that really overdue conversation.
Yara, thank you so much for writing the piece and for joining us today on Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Rethinking Palestine. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. For more policy analysis and to donate to support our work, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
بيني وبينك يا هالليل في حب غريب عبابي بتقعد يا ليل ومنسهر ليلي بيني وبينك في أسرار وبتعرف أحزاني تبقى ملق لي عهاك الدار وقله ما ينساني في البيت العتيق غافي على الطريق غافي حد الزمان يمكن بكرة الحبيب يمرق مثل الغريب وما يذكر اللي كان بيني وبينك في أسرار وبتعرف أحزاني تبقى مرق لي عهاك الدار وقله ما ينساني الغافي على الطريق الغافي حد الزمان يمكن بكرة الحبيب يمرق مثل الغريب وما يذكر اللي كان بيني وبينك في أسرار وبتعرف أحزاني تبقى مرق لي عهاك الدار وقله ما ينساني بيني وبينك يا هالليل في حب وغني عبابي بتقعد يا ليل ومنسهر ليلي
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
This piano piece may well sound ordinary to you until you realize that it was taught to young Chloe just last week by Janet, who's still teaching at 81. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.